It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Both Republican Party and Democratic Party officials are planning for protests during their conventions this summer. At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee next month, journalists will file their stories as police patrol the biggest political event of the election cycle.
A new book examines the long and complicated relationship between the police and press in the United States, with periods of coexistence and at other times open hostility, like after the murder of George Floyd in 2020.
Scott Memel is the author of Pressing the Police and Policing the Press, The History and Law of the U.S. Press-Police Relationship. He's an adjunct professor in the Dietrich College of Communication at Marquette University. Scott, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the Republican National Convention. Multiple law enforcement agencies involved in securing the convention next month, U.S. Secret Service as well. And it requires major coordination and media access and credentialing. What might relations be like between journalists and police?
Great question. And, you know, it's always topical because whenever police are around, often there's going to be journalists and sometimes vice versa. So what I found throughout my studies is that there's two major types of interactions between the press and the police. There's ones that I call cooperative coexistence, right, where either they're cooperating together in some way or they're just able to coexist. You know, the reporter's doing their job. The police officer, they're doing their job, and there's just, you know, there's no major issues there. On the flip side, though, there can be moments of contentiousness. So if the press is holding law enforcement accountable in some way, that can lead to some contentiousness. Or also, vice versa, if law enforcement targets the press with, you know, an arrest of some kind, some violence, a threat, anything along those lines, that's going to make it contentious, too. And so it's just kind of a wait and see game, unfortunately, of any of those are possibilities. We've seen in the past, DNCs, RNCs have led to some pretty violent confrontations between the press and the police, including 1968 in Chicago, very noteworthy moment. And so we just have to wait and see which of those categories will reign supreme, potentially both, potentially one more than the other. We'll wait and see.
Well, let's take us to 1968, Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And you point out that journalists are being arrested for trying to cover protests, and journalists felt like they couldn't trust police. The public felt like they couldn't trust journalists. What did this distrust stem from?
It's a fascinating moment in many ways, because up until this point, we're talking obviously civil rights era. You've got two institutions that are made up predominantly of white men. So you got law enforcement, historically, predominantly white men. Not entirely, you know, I don't want to paint in too broad a brushes here, but again, you know, overgeneralizations here. Same with journalism as well. And very much these two institutions, especially when we're talking about the 1920s to 1950s, that was an era across the United States of great partnerships between these two sides. And there's a whole variety of reasons for it, but one of which is it's white men dealing with white men, and there's friendships there. There's just an understanding of we'll help you out if you help us out, and we can have these partnerships, again, without that contentiousness that I talked about. Well, then something happens where you just have the kind of the chaos of these protests happening in Chicago. And all of a sudden, law enforcement start tackling reporters and journalists. They start targeting them with tear gas and, you know, other chemical agents. And the press is going, whoa, what happened here, right? I thought we were good, so to speak. And it was just a moment where it was a bit of a wake-up call for journalists and for protesters alike that law enforcement violence, they're not immune to it. And so we've seen, you know, the George Floyd protests. We could go through many other examples as well that those same trends have certainly continued. And with the key being, it wasn't brand new, though, either in 1968. As I trace in the book, we can go back, you know, all the way to the American colonies and see violence against the press by law enforcement. But as you asked in your question, it was just this key moment of division where the press for the first time is going, well, hold on a second. Maybe we don't have the symbiotic relationship we thought we had with police. And then other factors come into play as well.
Taking us then to 2020 and police and press interactions surrounding the murder of George Floyd. You put out the statistic, 131 journalists were arrested in 2020 while they are reporting on the protests that rose up around Floyd. Why are journalists being arrested?
Well, I think there's probably a few factors in play, right? We're talking about chaotic scenes where, and this is where we can give some deference to law enforcement, right? There's a lot going on, you know, just chaotic scenes where it's just a lot of people, a lot of crowds. And, you know, when you start to get forms of violence, when the protests start to get a little more violent for whatever reason that may be, it's going to put some extra pressure on law enforcement, obviously. Now, at the same time, we can also be critical of law enforcement too. And we can also say, these are credentialed journalists. They were wearing their credentials. They identified themselves as members of the press. They're there to do their jobs too. And the key is there's some really important messages, you know, racial justice messages coming out of these protests. And the press is there to make sure that those messages are amplified and heard, right? To inform the public and at the same time, holding law enforcement and government accountable as they're responding to these protests. And so you take kind of a combination of kind of a chaotic scene with law enforcement perhaps overstepping their bounds, not recognizing that these are members of the press, not taking a step back and learning, hey, that's a credentialed member of the media. And you get kind of a perfect storm that we saw not only in Minneapolis, certainly, but also across the United States.
Scott, did the events surrounding George Floyd's death lead to changes in how the press and police carry out their work now?
It certainly has led to reflection. My hope is that in my book, I make some recommendations how to improve the press-police relationship. I hope I can be part of those conversations. But at the very least, there's been some reflection in terms of, okay, as a law enforcement agency, how do we work with the press, but also vice versa? I teach media ethics at Marquette University, and it's a big question of how do we cover police? How are we critical of law enforcement? How do we make sure that we're acting in an ethical manner while making sure we're reporting the truth and all those key sorts of media ethics elements that we've all heard of before in different ways? And so I think there's been that reflection. In terms of tangible steps that have been made, that's where you'd have to look more at the department by department level. Mm-hmm. You could also look at, you know, FBI, statewide police forces like the Minnesota State Patrol. There's been litigation that's come down kind of through that's led to settlements in different cases between cities and journalists who are harmed during these. So certainly there's those types of tangible things that have come out. But more than anything, as I highlight in the book, it's just a greater awareness that, okay, this relationship obviously exists. There was a moment here of really serious contentiousness. So what does that mean for us now going forward? And hard to believe, but now 4 years after the fact, how do we still keep reflecting on those events and try and minimize that to the greatest extent possible?
We have Scott Memel with us. New book, Pressing the Police and Policing the Press. Memel is an adjunct professor at Marquette University in its College of Communication. You write about impersonations as a type of this contentious interaction between press and police. What are these impersonations like?
Yeah, it's really a fascinating part of the history of this relationship where, just to make sure we're all on the same page, you know, a journalist is going to pretend to be a police officer or some member of law enforcement, and then vice versa. A member of law enforcement is going to pretend to be a member of the press, a journalist of some kind. And it's fascinating all the different ways that this happens. I mean, you get cases where police officers are dressing up as close to a reporter as they can, right? And they've got their notepad, they're taking notes. Some even have had cameras before. To be fair, police have been exposed sometimes when a professional journalist will be looking at them and going, well, they're holding their notepad, but they're not taking any notes. Or, well, the camera's not even on and they're pointing it to the scene right now. So there's all these different ways that it happens. Journalists do the same deal where it's a little bit more rare because it's illegal, obviously, to impersonate a police officer. It's not illegal to impersonate a journalist, at least when we're talking about state and federal statutes. But it's unique. There's a number of ways that they're trying to blend in for any number of purposes. You know, for law enforcement, it may be to end a standoff or a hostage situation. In some cases, it may be to investigate someone. So they need to blend in and if you're acting like a journalist, someone may talk to you, right? And then for journalists, the same deal. Pretend to be a police officer, that may give you access you otherwise don't have. Of course, from that comes a lot of negative effects as you're kind of blurring these lines and just adding, again, more contentiousness to this relationship.
And in blurring those lines, the Central Intelligence Agency, you write about the 70s, that agents had been impersonating American journalists for decades. What have been the effects of that? And what was going on there in the CIA?
Yeah, so it became this very secretive but well-established practice. CIA personnel around the world would impersonate journalists or media organizations, sometimes with their blessing and sometimes not with their blessing, for any number of purposes around the globe. And you can imagine, we're talking about World War II, we're talking about the beginning of the Cold War. So obviously a lot going on in the international context around this time. And even to the point that the CIA had training programs of how to act like a journalist, how to sound like a journalist.
Wow.
Pretty fascinating, some of what's going on there. And so what are the ramifications from this? There are several, but ultimately it comes down to you're undermining the independence of these institutions, especially the press. Under the First Amendment, the whole idea is the press is meant to serve all of us as members of the public, almost like a fourth branch of government. But of course not, but as an independent an independent group where there isn't something where you have to be licensed to be a journalist, where there is this independence as an institutionalization that started in the early 1900s, really saying, okay, we want to draw boundaries around ourselves as journalists, as an institution, like in the sciences, like law enforcement was doing literally at the exact same time during the progressive era. So the problem is when you undermine that independence, you're undermining journalists' credibility, because now, I think we could all relate to this. You're not going to talk to someone if you're not sure they're a journalist. If you think they're a police officer, you're probably going to not be as willing to divulge your secrets or whatever information you may have. So credibility is at risk. News gathering is at risk. And on top of all of that, just making it harder for journalists to do their jobs. Again, it's adding a level of contentiousness because you're not going to be a happy individual if you're a journalist and all your sources all of a sudden aren't talking to you anymore because they think you may be a police officer.
I want to bring up these media ride-alongs that you write about.
Yeah.
And New Year's Eve, 1925, a reporter for the Kenosha Evening News does a ride-along with an officer and is even... you read about even driving the police car. What were the purposes of media ride-alongs, and what does that do to the press-police relationship?
Another fascinating part of the relationship, to be fair, with a lot of very similar effects, where you've got this blurring of the lines between these institutions, and it's going to undermine independence. It's going to, quite frankly, just make it harder for each to do their jobs properly. Because you've got police officers, if you've got a camera pointed at you, guess what? You're probably going to do your job a little differently, right? And by the same token, if you're a journalist and you're writing with a police officer, it can be pretty hard to be critical of them, right? Because you're going to lose that access. They're not going to be happy with you. It's harder to hold the police accountable as a result. These are effects that date back to the 1880s, when you see the very first examples of, and I use the term vehicles loosely here, but the very first police vehicles. These were horse-drawn wagons that, there are antecedents that there were horse-drawn wagons that were dedicated for firefighting purposes. But then around the early 1800s, Chicago, St. Louis, a couple other cities are thinking, well, what if we had one of these horse-drawn wagons, but just for the police? So they can get to a crime scene more quickly. They can detain someone and take them down to the police station, all that sort of deal. It's the very first time that there are dedicated vehicles, again, so to speak, for police. And right away, as soon as these are created, the journalists were there to cover these new horse-drawn carriages that were fascinating to them, but also riding along, going to the crime scenes, seeing what law enforcement was doing, who they were arresting on that given day. So 1880s through the present, certainly including that example, as you said, in Kenosha, 1925, a long-established practice with, again, those same types of negative effects that just make the relationship more contentious, more challenging, and just undermines the ability of the press and police to serve all of us as members of the public.
I wonder, could more training within the ranks of police or training for reporters improve how police interact with the press and vice versa? What would training look like?
I think that's absolutely part of the equation. If we're thinking about, okay, great, Scott, you've told us all about this history of this relationship. You've talked about the legal landscape. You know, so what, right? So what can we do about it? I think training is absolutely a part of the equation here. So for law enforcement, it's training in, you know, First Amendment rights, free speech, freedom of the press. How do you interact with journalists at chaotic scenes like a protest, and even in just kind of your everyday? How are you working with reporters at a crime scene or a place where maybe there isn't, you know, quite as much activity going on? And by the same token, I think you're absolutely right. You know, for journalists as well, learning about media ethics, again, a course I teach at Marquette University, key question is, okay, so what are the media ethics around reporting on police? There's a lot of discussion. You can look up some really great kind of research and videos online about how crime reporting can be very misleading, that because of the focus on, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, so to speak, that we all as members of the public have kind of a warped sense of just how much crime is going on in our communities. And media ethics and kind of training for journalists of how to properly report on crime and policing, absolutely, that should be part of the equation as well.
And finally, public information officers, that officers on the force who are specifically trained to work with the media, how has that affected our relationship?
Yeah, so again, the fascinating part of doing kind of this long history of the U.S. press police relationship is you start to figure out, okay, where do these things start to arise? And it's really, especially in the progressive era, the early 1900s, that you start to see public relations bleeding into really many aspects of our society, but including law enforcement as well. And that's going to gain a lot of steam, especially when you get to the 1960s and the 1970s as well. Becomes very much just an accepted part of law enforcement that you would have kind of these public relations efforts. And the main problem with that is you're adding a barrier, so to speak. You know, we're talking about two separate institutions. If journalists have free access to talk to police officers, to talk to police chiefs, you know, other members of squads, you know, detectives, whatever the case may be, that's a lot of good access. That's a lot of information you can compile. When there's one individual who's kind of spearheading those efforts, and again, I'm not trying to denigrate PIOs in any way. I think, you know, they do important work, but they're often one person or at most maybe one department, where now you're running into a barrier it's a step where now you're not getting immediately to those officers, to those officials behind the lines, you know, in law enforcement. So it adds that level of barrier, which can certainly be productive for law enforcement. But the question, of course, is, what information isn't getting out? What types of access are journalists losing? Again, all with the idea that there should be that media ethics element always behind the scenes as well.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Scott Memel is an adjunct professor at Marquette University, author of the new book, Pressing the Police and Policing the Press.